Hinshaw Insurance Law Radio is on the air. From Los Angeles, I'm Royal Oaks of ABC News and the law firm of Hinshaw & Culbertson, LLP, inviting you to join us for Hinshaw Law Radio. This program features prominent lawyers and insurance industry professionals discussing insurance and reinsurance cases, issues, and developments. Before we get started, a reminder that the information on Insurance Law Radio is provided for general information purposes only. Nothing stated in the program constitutes legal advice or creates any attorney-client relationship. You should consult directly with an attorney of your choosing if you wish to obtain any advice with respect to any claim or matter. Any views expressed are those of the guests and are not necessarily the views of Hinshaw & Culbertson, LLP, or any of its clients. And now we go to Chicago and your host for Insurance Law Radio, the co-chair of Hinshaw & Culbertson's National Insurance Services Practice Group, Scott Seaman.
Thank you, Royal Oaks, and welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Hinshaw Insurance Law Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. We are broadcasting from Chicago today, and there's finally a hint of spring in the air. And for all of our listeners out there, there will be much more than a hint of insurance claims insight on the airwaves in this episode, because we are joined by our special guest, Simon Laird. And Simon, before I introduce you properly, I have to say that even though we're broadcasting from Chicago today, I do feel as though we're in London in many ways. And so it's a good feeling, definitely trading up this time of year. Simon is the global head of insurance at the London, Singapore, and Hong Kong-based law firm of Reynolds, Porter, and Chamberlain, RPC as we all call it, and they do as well. Simon advises and represents insurers and other financial entities in claims and coverage matters. Simon delivers sensible, commercial, pragmatic advice to insurers and has a good way about him. Now, that's according to Chambers UK, and that's all true enough, but it's somewhat of an understatement, I would say, because Simon is a world-class thought leader in the area of insurance claims and claims resolution. And Simon, what a complete pleasure it is to have you. Welcome to Hinshaw Insurance Law Radio.
It's a pleasure to be here, Scott.
So we generally just go through and talk about some of the issues on folks' minds, but I want to begin by congratulating you on the release of RPC's latest annual insurance review. It's an outstanding resource, one that I've turned to in the past, and I was hoping you could provide our listeners with a little bit of background on the annual insurance review.
Yeah, well, the annual insurance review is a snapshot, historically a snapshot, looking back at claims trends through the year that's just gone by, so 2018, and then looking at claims trends in the year ahead for 2019. And I think really to deliver some of the value, it's about delving down into sector specifics, so the different lines of businesses. But I think one of the themes that we've certainly been talking about ourselves has been the globalization of insurance and the risks and the exposures. And so what was different about it this time was we looked at it from a global perspective as well, looking at some of these claims trends. So it was very, very helpful to get Hinshaw's views on some of what's happening in the US. And of course, there are some specific aspects, which is developments in the US, but there's also a lot of common claims issues and trends that you can see from the annual review that comes across all of the jurisdictions, frankly.
That's very true. And for the benefit of our listeners, it's organized in a very helpful and succinct manner, you know, capturing the highlights of in this review 2018.
That's right.
Century behind, but 2018. And then a glance into a sort of a preview of what to anticipate in the particular lines in the particular countries for 2019. It's an excellent resource. It's available on RPC's website, and we have linked to it on the hinshawlaw.com website, and we will link to it on this episode as well, so our listeners can conveniently click on and either download it or look at it. And I would say that then they wouldn't have to listen to the rest of the show, but that's not true, because we're going to get some insights and take it to the next level in some areas. And I thought we would begin by getting your high-level thoughts on a couple of things that are keeping claims executives up at night in various parts of the globe.
Yeah, I think that probably there's two main themes at a very high level that I think claims executives are grappling with at the moment. The first is costs and the cost of doing business from their side. And I think that that has an impact in terms of the technology they're looking at and looking to use to handle claims and handle claims more efficiently, but also the expectations from their service providers and how to manage costs. So I think that's a big thing, which is still on the agenda. I think more than that, they're looking at how they add value to their clients. And I think one of the interesting things is that the dialogue, I think, is changing, certainly from senior levels within insurers now, to talk about differentiating themselves. And you differentiate yourselves in the service. And for an insurance company, the service isn't just about taking a policy out. It's about when you call upon the insurer in that moment of need. And I think insurers generally are looking very carefully at how they can use claim service to really differentiate their products and give their clients value above and beyond just the comfort of an insurance policy that will respond in a time of need.
Yeah, and that, you know, it's interesting because particularly since the financial crisis of 2008, insurers have done a lot of things. It's true in the U.S. and I think globally as well. They've staffed up their in-house counsel. They've watched their outside spend. They've gotten a lot more sophisticated in the metrics that they use in evaluating the success of their claims operations and their outside counsel. But one thing I've noticed with all of the metrics and all of the focus they place on that is a lack of sometimes an appreciation or being able to attribute qualitative analysis to their claims resolution and their vendors, including counsel.
Yeah, and I think that's definitely something that we've seen in the UK and Asia as well. It's very difficult to objectively measure, I think, what the value and the financial value is on resolution of claims. It's very difficult to measure how clients, so the insureds, feel about the service they've received, and that really matters to insurers. I think that, like all these things, I think there's more and more tables and comparator tables, and some of this is broker-driven as well. Yeah. And I think what we've seen is a real emphasis around speed, and there's a question about, well, when does speed and quality of service, when that bit in the middle, so responding quickly is important, but responding quickly with the right answer. And it's easy to know where that sits sometimes, but there's a big grey area in between where I think it's unclear. And I think that's one of the challenges for insurers in terms of, I think this is a global theme by the sounds of it, is conveying to their legal providers and service providers generally what exactly they want from them in those types of cases.
Yeah, and we are in sort of this fast-paced, instant global environment where the old days of responding the next day, sometimes our insurer clients view that as being tardy. And by the same token, they're under those same expectations from their superiors internally and from their policyholders and other interest groups. So there really is that premium of responding and of being able to provide instant access to our clients, even if it's acknowledging the receipt and giving them some preliminary thoughts. But also there's always been a value placed on the company's portfolio interest, but now we're seeing those interests more and more being global, aren't we?
Yeah, absolutely. And that brings challenges as well for insurers. So certainly we've seen in Asia, for example, a few years ago, you didn't have as many claims people on the ground in Asia. If you take speed of service as an example, the thought of a claim being notified into Singapore and having to wait 8 hours before somebody picks it up in the UK, back in London, to actually respond to that just isn't quick enough. They need claims people out there, so the whole proposition is evolving. It's building up claims people out there. I think picking up on your other theme as well is that in terms of speed of service, sometimes you wonder where the balance is in terms of are we creating more work? Going to the right person for the right answer and knowing, even if it's not the person who's going to have the answer, but the person who can find out the answer the quickest, can save a lot of time and can deliver excellent service. And I think that's where the quality of products and going to people that really know what they're doing and can make decisions and can give you the answer as quickly as possible or find out the answer as quickly as possible is a real differentiator. I think some of that's getting lost in some of the service providers offerings at the moment.
Yeah, and I, you know, when I started out about 30 years ago doing this, it seemed like the claims side of the house rarely spoke with the underwriting side of the house. And, you know, nowadays, there's not only a lot more communications, the significance of getting timely information from one side to the other is critical because we're dealing with risk and we're dealing with claims and exposures that are evolving and not only on the claim side, but the policy forms, trying to keep track, for example, on various cyber coverages. It's not like there's an ISO form that's been in effect, like with a CGL or first party policy, and you go through a lot of time and you get regulatory approval. Companies are changing policies, not only to respond to claims and exposure concerns, but to provide value to policyholders.
I think that's right. And I think, again, they're looking to differentiate their products. So how do they do that with their policies? How do you, one of the things that insurers need to look at with globalization of risk and of their client base is, well, what if their clients are doing business in different parts of the world? And what are the regulatory consequences of providing some of that cover? So I think putting those policies together in a way which works, especially cyber is a really interesting one because we haven't tested how the policy is going to work. Still quite a young policy.
We're on new generations of policies before we've had judicial interpretation of prior versions.
Absolutely, absolutely. And the interesting thing with that is how quickly cyber fraud and moves. So no sooner are we going to get the judicial help in relation to how the current policies respond. No doubt we'll have a new wave of cyber phenomenon, which will have to test again how the policies are going to respond in the future.
That's exactly right. You know, before we get into some different issues and different lines of coverage, more globally, can you just tell our listeners two or three of the big regulatory issues and concerns right now in the UK and Europe?
So in the UK, from an insurance perspective, I think we've had some interesting recent developments because the insurance law in the UK has been very insurer friendly historically, and that's been re-looked at recently with the introduction of the Insurance Act, and that is more policyholder friendly now, which has been it's probably set in stone how the commercial reality of the markets were working, but that has changed and that's playing through at the moment.
Could you just digress a little bit and explain to our listeners sort of the contours of the Insurance Act?
Yeah, so the Insurance Act, the main difference for the Insurance Act as it was historically is that the remedy for non-disclosure or for misrepresentation could have been avoidance. So there didn't have to be any link necessarily between the non-disclosure or the misrepresentation and the claim that came through afterwards. So it was considered quite a draconian remedy in those instances.
Sure.
And what the Insurance Act does is change the remedies in effect that's available, and it makes it much more proportionate. So you have to have much more of a connection between the non-disclosure or misrepresentation. This is all absent fraud, so if you just take fraud out of it for a moment. But you have to have much more of a link, and there's got to be a much more proportionate remedy. So it could be, for example, that if somebody doesn't disclose properly what their sprinklers that they have in their property or their warehouse, and that has an impact because the insurer would have still written the risk had they known the correct information, but on different premium. Mm-hmm. Then the remedy will be the difference between those premiums potentially in that instance. So it's just making it much more proportionate rather than before. If there was a fire at the warehouse, insurers would have been able to avoid the policy.
Right. Now, this may be an instance where we're separated by a common language, because I would say privacy, you might say privacy. But talk a little bit about some of those regulations, because our industry has been focused not only as an underwriting and claims handling entity, but as a business entity on cyber regulations, particularly the New York Department of Financial Services regulations, which are almost now entirely in effect. And you've got some privacy regulations, and California has adopted some that will be in effect in the next year or so. So
yeah.
I think that's something that would be of interest to our listeners.
Yeah, so GDPR, GDPR, just as a business, any business, has been a huge event and has taken up a lot of time in really sorting out data and understanding who owns that data, what you can do with that data. And of course, that creates risk. It creates the risk of quite the fear that everybody has in the UK is that if there's a data breach and it has to be self-reporting now and it goes to the ICA, is the potential for some quite substantial fines. It's the fines that are really concerning people. And along with fines,
using that draconian word you mentioned earlier,
exactly.
The Insurance Act, yeah.
So it's the fines, but what comes with the fines is the reputational damage. So for insurers who have huge amounts of data, then they've been having to get around the head round what they do with that data, and what they certainly don't want is a fine as a result of something happening that their customers wouldn't want it to happen. I think that pervades into all sorts of lines of businesses. So we've seen Marriott Hotel, for example, and the that's probably the biggest data breach that we've seen in terms of sheer numbers. And that creates some quite sizable losses. And I think what we've seen in the UK is not just the statutory changes of GDPR, which as I say, is all focused about who owns the data, what you can do with the data, what you can't do with the data, but the courts are now starting to catch up in terms of remedies yet again. So one of the big cases that impacted in the UK in 2018 was the Morrison's decision. And that was about remedies that if you had your data taken, whether you could bring an action to recover that, which was something that, and also in that instance, that was an employee that leaked the data. And it was about vicarious liability and could the company be vicariously liable. And the court's thinking on that, and certainly some of the commentary, is going to make it easier as a result of that decision to bring actions for recovery of financial loss as a result of those data breaches. So you start adding those up when you've got hundreds, thousands of people that have suffered a data breach. And one of the interesting things about the decision was that one of the rationales the court gave for making it easier for people to be able to recover losses in those circumstances was because they refer to the insurance industry sitting behind and the evolving policy, cyber policy. So I think that's a big development. And I think in cyber in the UK, my sense is it's catching up with the US. The US is much further ahead in terms of the ability to sue for losses around data breach.
Yeah, we always seem to be leading the pack in terms of exposures, whether it's on the coverage side or the underlying liabilities.
I think that's right. And I think on regulation, I mean, the other really interesting thing at the moment is you can't talk about insurance and insurance of the future without talking about blockchain. Everyone seems to bring everything back to blockchain. And one of the things we're seeing globally with blockchain is talking around regulation of blockchain itself.
Yeah.
And we'll have to see how that plays out. But I think we're going to have to see how the regulators join up on it as well.
Yeah. And of course, GDPR is of interest not only to U.S. insurers from a claims perspective with claims there, but as a regulated entity, because you don't necessarily have to be UK-based in order to be subject to that regulation.
That's absolutely right. So if you've got data of an EU citizen, that's enough to be caught. So yeah, it's something that impacts on people across the globe. I think the other thing is that it's an interesting concept, though, isn't it? Because at the heart of it, it's a discussion around who's entitled to use data, who owns that data, is it your data, is it personal information, what can people do, can they make money out of that data? And I think that's why we're seeing different countries looking at this issue. So they might have their own version of the GDPR. You mentioned California, and that's something we've been sort of looking at from afar, just seeing to what extent is that going to copy parts of GDPR or where would it be different? And I think it will be driven by different people's thoughts on where the balance should be in terms of data and what can be used for that.
And then requiring insurers and other companies to play to the lowest common denominator, if you will, in terms of what is the most stringent regulation in a country that they're subject to regulations in.
Absolutely.
Because it's hard to contain data nowadays within geographical boundaries.
I completely agree with that. I think that's right.
So I know that these type of issues are keeping Facebook up at night, also insurers. Let's spend a few minutes and just allow you to highlight for our listeners some of the key developments over the past year or so in the UK, Europe, even beyond, if you're so inclined, by lines of coverage, starting with general liability.
Yeah, so I think with general liability, I think what's impacting in the UK is more around the industry, actually, what's happening at the moment. So in the UK, we have, for the lower value general liability claims, a cost regime which fixes the costs. And there's a lot of effort and thought going into how do we manage the costs associated with, and this is not just defendants and insurance companies and defendants law firms. This is law firms generally are being looked at very carefully about the costs and how proportionate they are to some of the losses that are being brought at the moment. So that regime is driving a couple of things. Because you've got fixed costs, you've got a change in the what we would call claimant profession back in the UK, the plaintiff profession. So it's changing the face of that, and that has an impact on insurers in terms of what claims are being bought. And then the technology that's being used in general liability by insurers at the moment to identify fraud, to process claims much more quickly, and potentially automation there is having a big impact.
And you mentioned blockchain, and that's really what carriers are looking for to result in substantial cost savings by providing information and exchange of information to reduce insurance fraud.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And theoretically, that should work. I mean, one of the challenges with blockchain, of course, is that you only need a capacity provider and you only need a customer. Yeah. And at the moment, the market is much more complex than that. But the output is absolutely right, that you have a claim, there's little wiggle room for fraud, albeit that's yet to be probably fully tested. But theoretically, little wiggle room for fraud, and the claim can be paid very, very quickly.
Yeah. Well, let's move over and take a look at professional liability and a couple of developments in that area.
Yeah, so with professional liability, I think one of the big areas for professional, well, there's two things I think with professional liability. Pensions is a huge as a area of exposure is an interesting area, and we've got the regulator more broadly with financial services type professional liability getting more and more heavily involved, and we have this disjoint between our regulator sometimes back in the UK between the law and the regulator's intentions, and the regulator sort of wants customers to be paid good, and they will want to do that without necessarily having the fullest regard to whether legally there's an exposure there. Mm-hmm. That creates tensions. And we're seeing that particularly if you've got pension losses. We had back coming out of 2008 with the credit crunch. What followed after that was the government looking to raise taxes. There was pension freedom, which allowed people to access their pension pots. And that created some tax benefits in terms of people spending some of that money. And what follows, like night follows day, there are claims off the back of that. There's issues as to whether pension trustees should be responsible for the decisions of customers who made a decision themselves to spend some of that money or to transfer it into higher risk investments, chasing that sort of really big return. So I think that's, and the regulator's impact on that is really driving some exposures in the UK at the moment, which the policies are trying to keep up with, because at the moment you have a policy which will only cover for legal liability. Well, if you've got a regulator telling somebody that they think the right thing to do is pay a claim out or a series of claims out, you could have a big exposure.
Right,
which theoretically under the policy is
regulatory compliance, cost of doing business, and that, you know, quote unquote legal liability under the policy.
Absolutely.
Quickly on D&O, a thought or two.
Yeah, so D&O, in terms of some of the themes coming from D&O, I think the big issue with D&O is in the UK is around, again, defence costs, actually. So I think my sense is, again, the US is slightly ahead of the UK in how it's able to manage some of those defence costs. Because of EU regulation, and we're recording this at a time when we don't know what Britain's relationship with the EU is going to be very shortly. But the under EU regulation, there is no way of actually, on a D&O policy, forcing a policyholder to use a particular law firm, which means that some of these policyholders turn around to their corporate law firms, mm-hmm. And who can be expensive and also not necessarily understand what insurers want in terms of reporting and reserving. And so what we're seeing in the D&O space...
And also, of course, rates through the roof.
And absolutely.
And, you know...
Absolutely.
D's and O's view every potential claim or piece of litigation against them as bet the company.
That's right. And I think we're seeing insurers being quite innovative in how they're coming up with solutions to manage that D&O defence costs under the policies. And they're thinking quite laterally in terms of how they can do that and play in firms that they are comfortable with, that will do a good job and will know how to report and will manage costs effectively for insurers.
Well, I'm going to really put you on the spot now and make you earn your pounds, because in studio with us today is James Miller, the chairman of RPC and one of the most knowledgeable minds on first-party coverage on the planet. So with that in mind, I'm going to ask you for a couple of your thoughts on developments in first-party property coverage.
Okay, so the I can see James just looking at me at the moment, smiling, waiting with interest.
He's taking notes, actually.
Yeah. So again, there's a couple of things. Well, I was talking about the Insurance Act changes. That has had the biggest impact in property because for two reasons. One is that with first-party losses, we're really testing that act in the UK in the property lines first, the long-tail business. We will have similar issues, but it will take a while for those to come through. So the impact of the Insurance Act. I think the other thing which has happened very recently, in fact, earlier this week, was that we have in the UK a financial ombudsman who can resolve policy disputes for retail clients, so just individuals as opposed to big corporations, albeit small businesses can also use the financial ombudsman. And they've increased the limits for what they can resolve at the financial ombudsman now to 350,000. So it's moved from 150,000 to £350,000.
Yeah.
So, which will be about $425,000 sort of US dollars type level. So if you can imagine the first party property, if you take out the frequent, well, you look where the frequency is, the big losses are fairly infrequent. They're the ones that take a lot of time, effort and cost, but it's the volume is at the lower end. And I think one of the big things for the first party property insurers in the UK is going to be the impact of having your policy issues resolved by an ombudsman who applies an informal non-legal approach to resolving those disputes. And actually £350,000 sterling, or sort of, you know, more than $400,000, is quite a big limit if you're looking at that in a volume business.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, on the reinsurance side, I know one big development is the US-UK covered agreement that was announced in December of 2018, dealt with three or four issues, but in particular issues of security, and that ties to the uncertainty associated with Brexit that you alluded to before, because the U.S. had in 2017 entered into a covered agreement with the EU. So now we're covered, or at least the framework is set for the covered agreement between our two countries.
Yes.
What else in the area of reinsurance?
I think with reinsurance, I think what we're seeing, I mean, again, just linking it with the theme of Brexit for the moment. So I think that we've got a period which is very uncertain in terms of what will happen as a result of Brexit. So what you've got is London domiciled underwriters who have to date been able to write European business. There is a question mark over whether they're still going to be able to do that in the same way. The truth is we simply don't know the answer to that at the moment. What that means is that one of the most commercial solutions to that is to open local offices to insure the business locally in Europe. But the reality is the talent is still going to sit in London to a large extent, particularly on the claim side. So what I think we'll see is more reinsurance. So you have fronting locally. You're going to have more more reinsurance work, which will come back to London. And as soon as you put another layer of complexity to write that European business, there will be policy issues, no doubt, as a result of that. So I think that is definitely going to be one of the things we're going to see coming through, is how they grapple with the wordings and what the consequences are when we start having claims come through.
In the U.S. in recent years, U.S. reinsurers have been struggling a bit because of alternative forms of capital and finding ways to add value to their seeding companies. Have you seen that as well in Europe?
We have. I think, we certainly have. I think there's, I mean, the other sort of things on reinsurance in the UK is my sense is that people haven't used reinsurance as much in the UK. There's been more people that have been prepared to take a bigger stake in what they're writing. And there's a sense around reinsurance as well that insurers are working more collaboratively and are not sort of getting involved in as many disputes. So when we have, say, the hurricanes in the US, we'll have big exposure in the London market to those hurricanes. You'll have the reinsurance issues that come through, and then you'll have retrocession issues in London. And they certainly, I think over the last 10 years or so, what we've seen is the London market working more closely together to resolve those issues between themselves rather than disputes which sort of go to arbitration or mediation.
Which, as usual, Simon, is a brilliant sort of segue because, when we're looking at climate change.
Yes.
Why don't I just give you a broad rein on that? What are your thoughts?
Well, climate change, I mean, it's fascinating, isn't it? Because there's a lot of uncertainty and unpredictability at the market at the moment. You started looking at risk. I think that's encapsulated by climate change because what we are seeing, I think, as a result of issues linked to climate change is probably the frequency of events, climate change events, say, of storms, hurricanes hitting, the fact that they're hitting outside of predicted periods. And I think that impacts in a number of ways. It creates environmental losses, so casualty type losses that are covered. I think on a political risks trade credit basis, it also has an impact as well. So, and contingency. So contingency is an interesting example because you'll have events, big events, which are scheduled for a certain particular period of time, particularly outdoor events. And if you start having storms and big events like that, which cause cancellations of those events, then I think we're going to start seeing more contingency policy claims as a result as well.
And when we talk about claims of the future, for years we go to conferences here in the U.S. and people would ask, okay, what's the next asbestos going to be? And different things have come and gone, and asbestos still growing strong. I guess I was rhyming that, not intentionally. I'm sure they'll edit my rhyme out. But when you look at what are going to be big claims of the future, my money's on cyber. What about you?
I would have to say the same. I think cyber. I completely agree. I think that I suppose pharmaceuticals is always has the potential. And again, I think you certainly from a UK and Asia perspective, we tend to look at what's happening in the US to see what comes out from the US first of all, because it's an early indicator of what might be global issues there. I think, but if you look at it across the globe at the moment, cyber has to be that big unknown. And has potential to be very significant exposure.
And you combine that with some of the blockchain issues we've talked about and the technology and the so-called Internet of Things.
Yeah.
A lot of things happening and at a quicker pace.
And I think the other thing is that as technology impacts on underlying risks, they become more interconnected. So when you start having losses, it might be a simple issue, but it's going to impact on lots more events or individuals, which means you're going to get bigger losses come off the back of it for insurers.
So sort of as a parting question, big picture in these fast-paced times in a global world, confronting the global challenges, what are a couple takeaway thoughts from you as a lawyer representing insurers to add value to the clients?
Yeah, well, I think the fundamentals are the same in terms of providing our clients with a quality product and a quality service, because that, as we were talking about right at the start, is I think how insurers are going to get the best return on their investment of legal spend. I think the other thing would be we've talked about a lot the uncertainties and the unpredictable nature of climate change, cyber. is really how we can start working together with a more global view to provide insight to our clients to help them navigate around some of those challenges, because they won't have the answer. And in many senses, there isn't an answer. But starting to think about what those uncertainties might look like and how that could impact their book of business from an underwriting perspective, from just even writing their business plans perspective, I think is where we can help insurers.
And as a final question, as we continue to move and look eastward, a thought or two on claims and claims activity in Singapore and Hong Kong.
Yeah, I mean, Singapore is an interesting area because it's a hub for Southeast Asia. And we're getting a lot of infrastructure being built in some of the countries around Southeast Asia. So I think we'll have some one-off big events which happen where we'll have some big claims arising out of that. The other interesting question with Hong Kong and Singapore is, we talked about cyber. Will we have the same volume of claims and activity in Asia, because it's a different culture in terms of accepting that personal data might have been taken and doing something about it, and a different culture in terms of how you as a business would deal with that if data has been taken. So that's sort of a really interesting part of the world to see what happens with that. In Hong Kong, I mean, Hong Kong is just a fascinating place because you've got, it truly is where East meets West. And I think because of that, there's a lot of business there. There's a lot of professional services, companies and issues and challenges there. And you've got, it is a hub where there is a well-regarded dispute resolution process. That's a good place for insurers to be doing business and a big market for them, because businesses like to be in Hong Kong as well.
Absolutely. And the challenges associated with a lot of people in smaller spaces, which is something actually some parts of the U.S. are confronting with city growth and being associated to events that then become larger in scale and scope.
Yeah, no, very much so, very much so.
Well, Simon, thank you so much for joining us on Hinshaw Insurance Law Radio. We look forward to dragging you back in here and getting your insights and drilling down on some of the subjects that we talked about, and we'll do that in a future episode. Simon Laird, Global Head of Insurance at RPC, has been our guest. And remember, ladies and gentlemen, to let us know if you have any suggestions regarding guests or topics of interest to insurance and reinsurance professionals or counsel for future broadcasts. We're always interested in hearing from you. This is Scott Seaman thanking you for joining us. We look forward to presenting the next episode of Hinshaw Insurance Law Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Royal Oaks, take us home.
You've been listening to Hinshaw & Culbertson LLP's Insurance Law Radio. The information contained in this program is provided solely for general informational purposes and does not constitute legal advice. For information on past and upcoming Insurance Law Radio programs, visit the Insurance Services Practice Group page of www.hinshawlaw.com. This is Royal Oaks thanking you for joining us and inviting you to join us for the next episode of Insurance Law Radio.
Morning people wake up for peace and quiet. McDonald's breakfast people, we wake up for the sweet rush of getting that warm, delicious breakfast right before it ends.
Be a McDonald's breakfast person and get a bagel sandwich. Imagine a fluffy egg, two slices of cheese, plus your choice of a steak patty, bacon, or sausage, all on a toasted bagel. Bagels are here at participating McDonald's.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.